So I'm Todd Wagner. I direct HERC. We do a bunch of query work where we're trying to estimate the budget impact analyses of implementation studies. So I have 47 slides today to get through in an hour. So hopefully we'll get through them. I just wanted to first acknowledge Jim Burgess. Jim was a champion of all things economic in VA. He died last year. The last time I presented this, Jim and I co-presented together, so he's greatly missed. Just to set the stage on some questions that people might be asking, we often get these kinds of questions. You know, you might have somebody who's developing new technology and says, wow, these new robots for stroke rehab, they sound really promising. What's their budgetary impact? Can we afford them? Then you might say, well, we understand that in VA, sometimes coding is imperfect. Maybe we should be hiring coders. That would be great, but it sounds expensive. Is there a value proposition to hiring coders? And then you might also hear, for example, there's this common term, return on investment. Is there any return on investment for providing naloxone free of charge to people who are overdosing or see people who are overdosing from opiates? So these are common types of questions where there's implicitly is a budget impact analysis. I wanted to step back a section and say a little bit about value. When you get into this world of budget impact analysis, it coincides with the broader question of value. And I'm going to have a slide in a second on healthcare and value, but I just want to frame it from an economics perspective. Economics defines value really to the purchaser, the consumer, is really the difference between the benefits received and the price paid. So everything you purchase in your daily life, you're spending your hard-earned money on it because it has value to you, whether that's a new cell phone, a new car, or so forth and so forth, even if it's just a gas for your car. Consumers measure the value of a purchase when considering an alternative for money. So implicitly, you're considering something when you're spending your money or what you would do with that money in an alternative world, perhaps an investment. Unfortunately, this economic definition of value doesn't easily translate to healthcare. There are things about healthcare that make it hard. One is, for example, when you're talking about purchasing coffee every day, that's something you understand. And if you don't like the cup of coffee from one purchaser, you don't go to them the next day. Same doesn't easily happen with hip fractures. You're not breaking your hip every day. You don't need a hip fracture replacement or hip replacement every day. There's also poor information on the benefits and costs. And we struggle mightily in this idea of what does value mean, but also it requires that we measure benefits in dollars. And historically, over the past 40 years in healthcare, people are really reluctant to do that. They prefer to measure benefits in things like mortality or quality of life or quality just life years. So in healthcare, values really come to mean incremental outcomes gained per dollar spent. And there's been a lot of work on this. When the change in outcome over the change in cost, you get to see this sort of value equation. And I just wanted to note that if you measure your change in outcomes as quality-adjusted life years, this is what we think of as cost-effectiveness analysis. This is your incremental cost-effectiveness ratio. There are alternative value equations. Things that VA is doing a lot of these days is trying to expand access. So it's not a choice about do I want to purchase this drug or not purchase this drug. These are things that are much broader. And so the quality ICER doesn't always easily translate there. And so some people are using proxies to measure value, whether it's a process quality or change in access. That makes it challenging in its own regard, because now we're talking about different numerators. There's also been a lot of interest in understanding what we mean by high-value care and low-value care. But generally speaking, low-value care is defined as healthcare services that provide little benefits to patients. So you'll hear this term come up time and time again where people are interested in disinvestment, things that we do that offer low value, trying to get us to stop doing things where it doesn't really benefit people. And there was a famous Institute of Medicine report not too long ago where they said we could essentially cut 30% of all healthcare spending and have no ill effects on patient outcomes. So that's quite a shocking number. Okay, so when we measure value in healthcare, like I said, there's different ways to measure the outcomes gained per dollar spent, and we talked about a little bit quality-adjusted life years. You might have mortality or proxies that go into that. And like I said, if we have outcomes equal quality-adjusted life years, this is just to reiterate, then our value equation becomes cost-effectiveness analysis. And the American College of Physicians and many others have endorsed cost-effectiveness analysis as the preferred method for measuring value. And this class that we've been teaching has really been about how to think about cost-effectiveness analysis. And I, before we go a little bit further, I want to, and the term value is, means a lot of things to many people. I just want to sort of break away and say, I don't want people to think of this as that it's a set of values. So I'm not referring to that. It's really just when you're spending money or purchasing things, how you think about the economic benefit that is given to you by that purchase. I also want you to think about values not being static. So if the purchase of that cell phone 10 years ago is very different from a purchase of a cell phone today. Similarly, when drugs decrease or increase in price, their value proposition changes. We can do less with the money if their prices go up. We can do more with the money if their prices go down. So value really is dynamic, which makes it really hard in this sort of ever-changing world. So there's been a long-standing interest in cost-effectiveness analysis. So if you go back to 1977, you get the famous Weinstein and Stason paper, which sort of sets forth the foundations for cost-effectiveness analysis. It's hard for me to believe that that was 41 years ago. There was then the Gold Book, and then there was this most recent edition that came out where they presented on the update to the Preventive Services Task Force on cost-effectiveness analysis. In general, people like cost-effectiveness analysis. There's a theoretical appeal to it, for why we think about it. And it's also suitable for drugs, surgical, and behavioral interventions. We've made some slight tweaks to that because behavioral interventions typically happen over a long run. There are challenges when we measure value, though, and these are pretty widely known. So the perspective really matters, and you've probably heard this throughout our cyber seminars. It's very different when you think about value from a patient. Maybe it's a provider perspective or a societal perspective. You can have situations where it's highly valuable to one but not valuable to another. We also recognize that the time horizon matters. So preventive services may offer little value in the short run but huge value in the long run. Conversely, surgical care may offer you huge value in the short run and then questionable value in the long run. And so forth. So understanding the time horizon really does matter too. And then measuring outcomes is also a challenge, and we often struggle to measure outcomes. And a lot of work that we've worked on and I've been involved in, we do these things where we're looking at, for example, the quality-adjusted life years, and we'll take the EQ5D, which is this five-dimension health state, and we can measure it. We can see differences across populations. But we then struggle to measure change throughout the EQ5D over time, even if patients say they're changing, so they're not always responsive. You might ask yourself, why the limited impact of cost-effectiveness analysis? And just to note that Medicare avoids the dollar discussion. It's actually prohibited from having a dollar discussion. One thing that I will note is that cost-effectiveness analysis, when they're done well, they tend to be expensive and slow. People often ask me what that means. Is that, you know, when we do them really well, they're a couple of years and they're a couple hundred thousand dollars to build these models that are very complicated but allow for probabilistic sensitivity analysis. So that's not easy to do for every purchase decision. We also don't typically do cost-effectiveness analysis for existing treatments. So Sterling Bryan, who's an economist at the University of British Columbia, has written a couple papers sort of focusing on our focus on adoption. And he's encouraging people to do cost-effectiveness analysis more broadly, not just when we're adopting new treatments. But then we also recognize that they often, even when we publish them, they often have a limited impact on providers. We hear from providers that these findings are great and so forth, but they don't reflect my patients. My patients are just different. And then you also have differing incentives so that even if they recognize that it's good for their patients, perhaps the clinician's incentives differ or the healthcare system's incentives differ. I just wanted to highlight one of these examples, which is the clash of perspectives. And this is what's going to lead into the budget impact analysis work that we're doing. So over the past two decades, if you're interested in substance use treatment, you would see a literature that is large and growing that says substance use treatment was cost effective. Susan Ettner has done some of the pioneering work in this work, in this field. And yet at the same time, we see this large contraction of treatment programs. So it's a ironic situation that you would say, hey, if we believe that policy follows good science, why would you say that we're contracting these programs when these programs are providing benefits? So this is really a struggle for a lot of us. Like I said, Susan Ettner found that substance use treatment was cost-effective due to huge savings in criminal justice. Now, that might alone give you a sense of what's going to be the budget impact problem here, is that we're dealing with different perspectives. And when Keith Humphreys and I looked at this further in VA, we found little evidence to suggest that if you invest in VA substance use treatment, that there's benefits to the healthcare system itself. And so again, going back to Susan's work, maybe the benefits are not to the healthcare system, but are to a different system. And so you have to justify these expenditures, which might be very tough to justify it for a healthcare system. So up has come this field on budget impact analysis. This immediately say is, what's the budget impact from investing in a new program? So what it's going to do is it's going to involve an evaluation of a scenario rather than a single action, because healthcare systems are, you know, focused on scenarios. You're going to include a comparison to the status quo, because that's what the healthcare system struggles with. And then you need to do some sensitivity analysis to figure out how sensitive your analysis is. But these are not typically done to the level of rigor or extensiveness that often happens with some of these more expensive models. I will note that the BIA will focus in predominantly on the payer's perspective. So if you're interested in substance use disorder treatment, you would then focus on what's it mean for the healthcare system, and then you would note that maybe there are big gains outside the healthcare system, but then how do we get healthcare systems and criminal justice systems to talk, and how do we share money and create aligned incentives? So, and you might have more than one organizational perspective. So for those of you in VA, just to recognize is that you could start at your clinic or your specialty area. You can then say, well, the bigger one is the VA Medical Center. Maybe you're up into the VISN, and then VHA as a whole. So you can think about having different implications there. Excuse me. We also typically exclude patient costs unless they are reimbursed by the provider. So in VA, there are times where VA will pay for travel. In this case, you would include those. But typically, again, if we're taking the payer's perspective, you would exclude the patient cost. The other key feature for budget impact analysis is usually it's a very short time horizon. Most of the time, we're talking about a year to three at most. And so long-term modeling, even though it's preferred, excuse me, for cost-effectiveness analysis, are not typically done for budget impact analyses. We don't discount the costs, and then savings far in the future cannot offset the initial startup costs of the investments. So we have to think carefully about how we're going to structure and capture these costs. And I grab a sip of water here so I don't lose my voice. Excuse me. Okay, so BIA does not measure non-financial outcomes or utilities. Now, you as a researcher may want to do that to understand what's else going on, but the budget impact analysis itself is mostly focused on just the financials. So at its core, there's no need to survey patients. There's no calculation of quality-adjusted life years, and then you key here is you can assume that the outcomes are known or ignorable. Now, that doesn't set well with many researchers. So I will say that there are many times where we'll say, let's do the budget impact analysis, but let's also do the broader analysis, whether it's cost effectiveness or understand the outcomes, to make the preposition about here's your budget impact analysis, but maybe there are other things that we need to consider that are not just financial. So in a typical budget impact analysis framework, you need to estimate the cost of the intervention, and we're going to walk you through all of these for the rest of the day today. Change in staffing, and perhaps there's schedule changes in use of technology, how that might affect patient access, demand, and so forth, and then your downstream financial costs. Okay, so here's a schematic. Hopefully you can follow it. This was initially proposed by the International Society for Pharmacoeconomic Outcomes Research, so it is poor. And typically they were thinking about doing this for a drug. So you would have your current environment, which is on your left. You're going to read from left to right here. What's going to change in their model was that you would have a purchasing a new drug. So you'd say, well, let's look at the total population, the sick population, the target population, resources that comes up to your cost of illness. Under a new drug scenario, a new treatment scenario, maybe it changes the incidence or prevalence of the total population. Maybe it changes the percent diagnosed or treated. Or maybe it's the target population, the current way we treat patients, and so on and so forth. Maybe it's so simple that it doesn't affect any of those. It just affects the unit cost of treatment. And then you can sort of translate that to your new environment. Maybe it changes your total population, or maybe it's only affecting your target population or resources, and you come up with a new cost of illness. And then you would say that the difference, the bottom line between those two, the old state and the new state, is your budget impact. I will say that we're actually currently working on a paper right now. It's really simple when you think about this from a perspective of plopping a new drug into the system. It's much harder when you think about it's not a drug, but it's a process improvement change, because drugs are very different than putting in people to change the system and reorganizing the system. So keep your ears peeled for that. But the population could be all veterans, as I said. And you can easily go into databases here, whether it's the CDW, to understand how we get the data on the total population to understand changes in prevalence or incidence. Oops, that didn't come out. So then you could also understand the use of existing resources and change on resource consumption. Again, you could go into VA databases if perhaps you're interested in understanding exactly what's going on there. What I'll be focusing on the remainder of today's lecture will be looking at how we think about the resource parameters. When we go from unit costs in the new or the old to the new, how do we think about estimating those? A lot of time we'll spend on that. All right. In this regard, I just want to be clear. It's easy to confuse costs and outcomes, and we see it happen a lot, especially when outcomes can be measured as costs, reduce hospital stays, and so forth. So the first rule in budget impact analysis is just to focus on the denominator. You can track outcomes all you want. I would actually encourage you to do so, but just track the money. And I, as an economist, I first to say that not all factors that are easy to measure in dollars are everything that should be measured. There are other important factors that you have to keep in mind. So if you have kids that are in schools, it's not just about, you know, the cost of running the schools. It's also about, you know, having a great place for your kids to learn. The same is true in healthcare. So not everything important is easily measured in dollars. When investing in a new technology, it's often easy to confuse inputs and outputs. So when you think about the budget impact analysis, I want you to think about what is it we're purchasing here? That's an input. And then the outputs might be how does it affect downstream utilization? So the input could easily be, if we go back to those examples, that new robot we purchased for stroke rehab. Maybe it's we're purchasing naloxone to give to everybody who gets an opiate. Maybe it's we're hiring new coders. Those would be our inputs. The outputs would be the downstream effects. So maybe it's, you know, reducing the number of overdoses related to opiates. That would be the downstream effects. Maybe it would be reduced inappropriate care costs. from, you know, coders or whatnot, maybe there would be some increased downstream effects if we people love these things and come back for more and more care. So it's not always a negative savings, if you will, on the downstream. Sometimes we can do things that increase downstream. So BIA rule two, track your inputs and outputs separately. And then just don't track the averages, but track the distribution of inputs and outputs. What you're eventually going to try to do is present something that's going to be on sort of what's the cost to replicate this study that you're presenting on. And just providing averages sometimes hides the fact that there can be wide variance, and that wide variance matters. So it's very different to say that, you know, you're purchasing a $1,000 chance to win $1 million. Inputs are known. Outputs are sometimes uncertain. I've been involved in a lot of budget impact analyses where we know that we're going to be spending money up front and the downstream effects are uncertain. Decision makers want to know that. They know that they're investing up front for an uncertain downstream effect, and they might not be willing to make that bet. I also should note that sometimes you'll see huge skewness in your distributions, which is common. Some people have used medians, but generally speaking, economists prefer averages over medians because that you want to understand the outliers. As long as you believe they're real outliers, you want to include those. You don't want to penalize people for having expensive patients. So the other thing to note is that your costs will reflect your environment, and the current environment is really important, especially if you're doing implementation research. But it also means that this environment is what's generating your cost data that you're looking at. So all of the cost data in the CDW that VA looks at comes through an accounting process that reflects what's happening at that site. So if it's the cost data that's for Palo Alto, it reflects the wages here in Palo Alto, which are about 73% higher than the national average. So think about that when you're thinking about this cost-generating process. And like I said, these costs can differ in very observable ways, for example, the wages, but it could also be for other things that are going on, utilities. We see very different utility usages across facilities. Costs can also differ in less observable ways. The two that are going to come back to haunt us time and time again that we struggle to see in data is perhaps the system is inefficient or they differ in quality production that you can't easily see in the data. So maybe it's that Palo Alto's expensive because our wages are higher, but that there could be other things in the mix that make Palo Alto different from Houston, Texas. Maybe it's efficiency and quality, and there's no parameter in the CDW that says Palo Alto is highly efficient and Houston isn't, or this clinic is and this clinic isn't. Or maybe it's that this clinic's high quality and that clinic's not high quality. You just don't see that. These two issues are going to be really, really critical. And you're going to feel this tug of war, and I like having this, the tug of wars. I can't tell you how often this comes up. So in economics, you're trained on the left-hand side. People who train in economics think about, all I care about is understanding causality and generalizability. The context is noise to some degree, and I want to ignore it. If you're an implementation science researcher, you're probably going to be on the right side and think, wow, the context is really meaningful. I really want to understand how this affects the implementation, the quality improvements, and you're going to feel this constant tug of war. Do we care about causality and generalizability, or do we care about context? And I would say that in both cases, when we feel this tug of war going on, we got to work together to figure out, yes, it's important to understand generalizability and causality, but it's also important to understand the context and why these things differ. So maybe we need to be hugging instead of pulling apart, but to recognize that if you're feeling this tension, the field is feeling this tension, and we have to do a little bit more to understand if you're doing implementation work or budget impact analysis, the causality and generalizability in this process. I'm going to give you an example of what this means in outside of healthcare. And I do this because when I start getting to this issue of healthcare, especially for people who are relatively new to healthcare, especially when I start talking about quality and efficiency, is they don't get it. But everybody gets cooking. Most of us cook. So in healthcare, in cooking, it's a natural sequence of events, and this is going to happen just like in healthcare. So you're going to buy the ingredients, you're going to use the equipment, you're going to cook the meal, and then you're going to clean it up. wow, that sequence of events is going to be very much like a healthcare process. So in cooking, you're going to buy the ingredients, you're going to rent your space, you're going to have your cost of cooking and your cost of cleanup. So there's, again, this cost goes into it. The production process in this producing of food, two things are going to come up. One is efficiency. Think of yourself as a cook. Maybe you're great with knives. You're highly trained. You went to the Culinary Institute. You know exactly how to mix things and cook things, and you're very, very efficient. So you're using the same resource to produce more outputs, or maybe you're using fewer resources to produce the same number of outputs. The other thing that's going to come up is quality. Maybe because of the way you cook, you know, you can time everything, and when the shallots come out of the oven, they're perfect and timed with the halibut, and it's just great quality, and it's just perfect. Whereas other people, you know, one thing's getting cold while the other thing's getting overcooked, and so quality is really important. So these things translate to healthcare. So think of the different ways that I want you to think about efficiency and quality in cooking and how they might translate to healthcare. So good equipment matters with cooking. Well, good equipment matters in healthcare too. Skilled labor matters in cooking, and skilled labor particularly matters in healthcare, many of the things that we do. And you're going to see these things in great restaurants where they're learning by doing and their specialization. That's exactly what we're doing in healthcare. So you'll see in surgery, for example, there's a lot of questions about volume and outcomes. Maybe we should learn by doing more of these things and specializing in them. So maybe if you're interested in oncology, you would say, how do we specialize in this and understand improve the quality of these production processes. So these issues largely transfer to healthcare, but hopefully you'll understand there's no metric in your CDW data set that says this is a highly efficient process, this is a high-quality process. And you're going to have to think about that when you're doing your budget impact analysis. There are two other things, and I was just going to point out Ken Arrow's paper. There are a couple other things that make healthcare different from cooking, aside from the obvious. One is this issue of risk, and the other is this issue of uncertainty. And that is, when you cut an apple one way, you expect every time you cut an apple, it's going to get cut the same way, and you can do the same thing to it. If you cook it a certain amount of minutes, you'd expect the same sort of process on the same amount of heat. That doesn't happen in healthcare. So healthcare people are different. You can do the exact same surgery to one patient and get a very different outcome than doing the exact same patient surgery to a different patient. So just to return to healthcare, hopefully you didn't mind my little venture into cooking. I generally, when I present this, people like the idea of cooking because everybody cooks at different levels. And you can also think about, like, the restaurants you go to. You could think, all I want to do is minimize my cost and, you know, maximize my, you know, free time. And so you might go to fast food every day. And other people might say, no, I really want to, you know, maximize or minimize different parameters, and they might choose different restaurants. So like I said, efficiency and quality are important in healthcare. They are often unobserved. And so it becomes really tough. It gets back to this tug of war of understanding the contextual issues here and how healthcare production it relates to cost and quality. They can have a huge impact on your budget impact analysis. So if you're focusing in on a highly inefficient, high-quality site and don't understand that they have those two things, you might say that the replication cost of this this new study would be X, but it would not replicate elsewhere because of these. Implicitly, there's this other issue that we typically want people to be aware of, which is called economies of scale. And this is in the production process, the more you do it, typically what happens as you produce more of these things, you have increasing returns to scale. So if you're just doing one heart surgery a month, you may be pretty inefficient at doing that heart surgery. And then if you start doing more and more heart surgeries, assuming you're a surgeon, that you're getting more efficient at it to a point where you're sort of at constant returns to scale. And we often assume people are at constant returns to scale. And maybe if your production gets too big, you start flowing too many, you could have some decreasing returns to scale. So you'll often hear in the business world, companies merge or acquire each other with the idea that they can have economies of scale. but that if we get too large, and dare I say, you know, the VA might be somewhere on this, is that you might have decreasing returns to scale, that it's, there's a huge amount of effort and money spent on keeping the organization afloat. And I've even heard Google talk about they spent a lot of money making sure that each component and division in Google understands what the other component and division are doing. That takes resources to do that. So at some point you might say, are we at a decreasing returns to scale? So the cost and the budget impact analysis are based on this local context, and you have to understand sort of implicitly where you are on these scales. So let's just focus in on surgical care. Just like cooking, surgical care has different components that feed into it. You can have the pre-op, you can have the surgery, you can have the post-op, and maybe the discharge planning. What you're typically going to see when you start looking at cost data in the CDW or in any data set, this is true with Medicare, is you're going to see a summary total. And what's often more challenging is to understand what that summary total breaks down into. You don't typically see a pre-op cost different from the operation cost, different from the post-op, from the discharge planning. You typically see, here's the cost of that stay. So you have to understand a little bit about this process, because sometimes you want to intervene on one of these processes and you might have an effect on a different process. Each of these things often will have different components. We can think about as labor, maybe there's some pre-op labor, some space, supplies. So what we're often going to be doing is measuring these things with what's called micro-costing methods. So you'll get in there and say, hey, maybe we want to change the pre-op structure of care. Well, then we'd have to figure out, are we adding more labor? Do we need more space? So you start getting into the nitty-gritty, and those typically are the five categories of cost that we're interested in measuring. So you can do the same thing for surgery. Surprise, you can do it for post-op and discharge planning too. So you're going to end up with this cost of the intervention. You're going to have to micro-cost it. If maybe your data already exists and you don't have to do extensive time and motion studies, you can use something like a cost regression. You can say, hey, maybe this has been done elsewhere, and we can use the data from that to regress on VA or vice versa, or generate a pseudo bill, sort of what we think it would charge based on CPT codes. But most of the time, we're not in that world where cost data already exists. You're creating something really novel and new, and you have to do direct measurements. So you're going in there thinking about how does the labor cost differ? And so you're going to have to go in there and actually directly measure. And we've seen different people do it different ways. Some people will do random sampling and say, hey, I'm interested in, figuring out how the new staff mix affects things, because they don't want to measure and track every minute of the day for the staff, so they'll do some random sampling. But you have to get in there and think about how does the new labor affect your cost structure. And just to note that often we assume that, that quantity and quality are stagnant over these things. And we have a certain pay scale. We'll say we're just going to hire these people. But if you hire people in different ways, you can have dramatically different effects here. And typically, when you have a new intervention that has new labor, you want to think about, are you going to pay them benefits? You would include those when appropriate. And then people are not 100% productive. We have to include some non-productive times, things like when they're in meetings, maybe they're getting trained to do this better. You have to include those times too. So maybe you're developing a new intervention that's heavily labor intensive. You're going to spend a lot of your time trying to figure out what's the actual cost of this labor and what are the buckets for those things being spent on. Is it mostly training? Is it mostly, providing care to patients, and so on and so forth? Maybe they're involved in some supplies. And a lot of the interventions that we've been called on, so a recent one that I was involved on was looking at using health coaches to improve disease management for people with diabetes or chronic conditions, diabetes, heart conditions, and so on. And so it was a heavily labor-focused intervention, and the supplies were quite small. But you could also come up with another intervention that maybe is much more supply intensive. And there are ways that you could think about measuring the cost of your supplies. But for example, in that health coaching example, we ended up just tracking their supplies and asking them questions on the supplies. It was largely like they needed a computer to have access to the databases. They needed some paper and pencils, but you can do away with a great precision there because it's quite easy to estimate those costs, and they're pretty small. But the labor workers, those outreach workers, needed space to work in, and we had to measure the quantity of space for their desk and what they needed for storage and so forth. In that case, we use retail and office space. You can easily measure sort of the cost of these things in public databases. What's much harder is measuring sort of changes in hospital space. There's no public database that says what it costs to expand on a square footage the cost of your hospital. Stanford's involved right now in building a new hospital, and it's one of the most expensive hospitals in the world, in part because of all the seismic and everything else, but we just don't build hospitals fast enough, quick enough, whatever the right adjective is, to understand sort of what's the cost per square foot of a hospital expansion. So many of the things that we end up looking at would be, hey, if you're going to do this intervention, could office space be used as a proxy for that? So you have to measure the space cost. And then you're going to run a bunch of sensitivity analyses to test the robustness of your results. Often we're changing the assumptions of the model to see how the final outcome changes. And Risha Gadwani, in some previous examples from cyber seminars over the past 2 months, gave some much more sophisticated sensitivity analyses. I will say in budget impact analyses, they tend to be pretty straightforward, and you're changing what would it mean if the labor were more efficient? What would it change if there were different wages? And so those might be some of the parameters you might vary. Most of the time, you're going to change one of the parameters at a time. And this is the easy way to do it. It's not necessarily considered state-of-the-art. The state-of-the-art would be sort of multiple changes at once, which you would probably require software or a formal economic model. These would be the most credible if you're trying to publish it. They allow you to graph it. You can get not only sort of your averages, but you get distributions around your averages. But typically, budgets don't often allow for that. So you have to sort of figure out what's possible in your study and your grant. The other budget impact analysis, and this is rule number three, is estimated savings are not revenue. And I can't tell you enough that people assume if we say, here's your estimated savings from running this intervention, and I'll give you a concrete example here. I was working with a surgeon who was interested in getting low acuity people out of the ICU. And so he did this huge, beautiful study to show that there's a lot of very sort of, they're sick, but they're not that sick, or they could be managed in medical ward beds, and what would be the estimated savings if we got them out of the ICU. But the savings doesn't happen until we close the ICUs. So if you just put other patients in those beds, you didn't save anything. In fact, you just made those patients more expensive because now they're getting the ICU. So estimated savings only happen if the decision maker makes actual structural changes to save money. So I should also note that organizations often prefer strategies that increase revenue versus those that cut costs. It's very hard to cut costs. It's much easier to say, hey, will that change our revenue stream in some way? So be very careful of this sort of differences between revenues, costs, and savings. I'm going to give you an example here from Ben Druss and his work of a budget impact analysis. This was being worked on with seriously mentally ill. So when we presented this last, we liked it because it relates to VA and all the work that VA does with the mental illness. And Doug Leslie, who's now, I think, at Penn State, used to be at Yale and the Northeast or in the West Haven VA there. So give you just an outline and the brief conclusions of the study. So they randomized 407 seriously mentally ill psychiatric outpatients to usual care or to care coordination. So this is a labor-intensive intervention that uses a medical care manager to coordinate their care. So think of it as this broader issue of coordination of care, and VA is very interested in this right now. So this is a question of integrating across primary mental health. Maybe there's questions of cardiac health, and the quality of care clearly increased in this from this study. We can also, they tracked the cost, and they said that with confidence intervals, they can understand that the cost from the healthcare system perspective spanned zero. So on average, it saved money, but it didn't save money at the 95th percentile confidence interval. But they also did this really cool thing, which they said they could figure out what the break-even point was. And they said, hey, because a lot of these patients are uninsured, they recognize that if 58% of them had insurance, they would actually be cost neutral. Unfortunately, in that clinic, only 40% of the patients were on Medicaid, so that they were going to lose money. And so this is not only interesting in terms of for the decision maker, but you could think and then think about, are there ways that we could perhaps get those people insurance? Or does the ACA change the way that we look at this intervention? Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. But that's very useful information for the decision maker to think about this study. So the budget impact analysis assessment and the assumptions, it really required careful assessment of the cost of implementing the intervention with a very short time horizon. They really focused in on the labor costs of these care managers. In this case, it was an urban community mental health clinic, and so there was a mix of patients who were both insured and uninsured, and only those patients were considered for the analysis. So it might be a very different thing if your clinic is interested in this intervention, and you might go back and say, would we break even? Then you might say, well, let's look at the number of patients who are insured in our clinic. So they considered the Medicaid rates as terms of sort of the cost of their care, and looked at what seriously mentally ill patients are in the Medicaid eligibility rules, which is critical to the BIA. And then they measured all the care management implementation costs because they knew this was a very heavily labor-intensive project. More broadly, what does this say for BIA work? This is the budget structure that we're thinking about here really matters in terms of how we want to replicate these costs. And what they did, which I thought was really novel, was they considered this idea of a break-even point, which was to say, we recognize that there's revenue that comes in that could be used to spend on these different things. When would it be revenue neutral, and at what point would it save money? So even though the program looked like it would save money on average, the program stopped because essentially for the near term it was going to lose money. So you have to start making these broader questions of, well, what's the broader value to the healthcare system, maybe society, from running this program? Are there other ways that we could finance it or get it run or argue that it should be kept as a benefit? So, again, this means that you have to think more broadly in terms of this issue of value and maybe outcomes to the patient that are more than just the financial. And the other thing that I liked about this project is that it considered the costs and the in the sensitivity analysis that you could understand exactly what this might mean for different managers or healthcare systems who are interested in picking up this this intervention. But it also highlights some of the challenges in doing budget impact analysis because they're so context dependent that sometimes it is hard to get these published because it might be just for one specific context. There's a lot of international interest in budget impact analysis, and I think in part because of the pushback, as I was referring to earlier, on cost-effectiveness analysis, that cost-effectiveness analysis is really useful to have, but it doesn't often tell us about where we're going to have friction points, perhaps between criminal justice and between healthcare. So in what we've seen so far in Australia, for example, they encourage people to take the government perspective because the government's funding most of the public health care. You can actually have private insurance that adds in wraparounds your services there, but they're wanting it from a government perspective. They ask for five-year time horizons. They don't want non-healthcare costs included, and they don't want discounting. In Canada, they're interested in sort of the provincial perspective, which is the drug and health of the social system there, or sorry, the drug and health system there. They want three-year time horizons. They don't want other costs, but they do want discounting. And you can go on and see what's happening in these different systems around the country. You'll notice that there's really no standard here in the U.S. about what is the standard. VA is a leader in doing budget impact analyses. As a system, we're very interested in understanding how to distribute money, how to make the best use of that money. I'm very proud to be part of the VA, and we're often getting asked to be involved in budget impact analyses, but there's no standards ways of doing it. What we're trying to do is understand what does this mean typically in an undiscounted way in 3 years, and then provide context so that people at different other VAs could understand, does the context matter, or how could they change the parameters to reflect their context. We have a bunch of resources on our website that you can go to for more information on calculating specific costs. So you can find guidebooks, there are technical reports on looking at labor costs and so on and so forth. And then we have some past cyber seminars if perhaps you're interested in learning more about the cost effectiveness analysis and weren't able to attend those. Maybe you're doing a budget impact analysis right now and you're really interested in just jumping into data. And so Virec on their intranet site has a lot of information on different user guides for data. Maybe you can jump into the CDW data to try to understand the prevalence of these illnesses or the number of people getting treated. Maybe you're interested in using the MCA data for looking at the unit costs. And they have a fair amount of information on pharmacy technical reports if you're interested in pharmaceuticals. And we have like I said, on the intranet sites, we tend to have more VA-centric information and specific data if you're interested in it. We also have, there's information out there for decision models. I would encourage you, if you're interested in this area, the three journals that typically publish a lot, and there's other journals that do too, but Medical Decision Making is just a leader in this field. Health Economics tends to publish a lot of interventions or projects that perhaps have a medical care bent or a health policy bent, and then Value in Health is increasingly these, but Value in Health often, I would say the majority of their studies tend to be more pharmaceutically focused, not all of them, but they tend to be. And I will say that there's a tension in the field about should economists get involved. I don't think you have to be an economist to do a rigorous budget impact analysis. You just have to be careful. We sometimes struggle to publish these things, so you'll find that some people are reluctant to get involved because they are so context specific. If you do this great study in three sites, it may not generalize to other sites unless you can say more about things like efficiency and quality and the parameters that matter at those sites. So providing some semblance of the context is really important, not only for understanding the intervention, but to getting it published as well. Otherwise, you'll probably struggle in that regard. And then the ISPOR recommendations, you'll see they've published two papers. Josephine Nauskopf has also given a talk here at HERC, and you can find that on our archives of cyber seminars. And I know Sean Sullivan took over the second paper there, the principles of good practice for budget impact analyses. What I would say is that's great, especially if you're focused on pharmaceuticals. Where I think we struggle is these process improvement interventions, just like the DRUS example or the health coaching example, where they tend to be labor intensive. We have to think about how we're paying our labor. We have to think about sort of the quality of the labor that we're hiring, how efficient the labor are, and that's why I went into that example of cooking. I really have to be careful with labor interventions. And then there's some increasing number of budget impact analyses that are happening on the VA side, and you can see an example here from JGM from the Luck article. I think that's the last slide I had. So, Joe, how are we doing on questions at this point?
Yeah, we have one question that just came in asking, what do you think of the ICER Institute in the U.S.? Do you think they'll eventually become the health technology agency for the U.S. in the future, similar to NICE in the U.K.?
So Steve Pearson and ICER, I know that there's a number of people who are linked to it in VA. I don't have a crystal ball about whether they will be the NICE, some structural differences. So, NICE is largely funded through the government and has, I'm just amazed at the thoroughness of their reports. When you start to get into them, they're often hundreds of pages long, so they're very, very detailed and technical. I'm a huge supporter of NICE, of NICE and of ICER. I can't say enough great things about ICER. What I think at some point we have to be thinking, though, policy-wise, is we have to touch that third rail, which is that Medicare has to start thinking about costs. And from right now, Congress prohibits Medicare from doing that, and so you find all these growths like ICER and so forth, but really Medicare is the driving force out there. And what I hope is that ICER is helping us understand the value of having these discussions, and then eventually we'll have a broader discussion about how do we have this from the perspective much more like NICE in the UK. So different people. Joe, do you have thoughts on this? You spent a fair amount of time in Canada. So how does technology adoption and so forth reflect your thinking on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be nice to have something similar to NICE or CADTH in Canada, something to provide some more guidelines along that line. But I can't speak specifically to the ICER Institute. I'm not really familiar with what they do. So. But I know we use them a lot in Canada and CADTH a lot, and we refer a lot to the work done by NICE. So.
Yeah. What I would say is, just as a one last comment on that, where I think VA is struggling with is these interventions that are very diffuse. Hey, let's improve access. So it's not necessarily purchasing something. It's a much bigger strategic change. And I think it's very different to think about the value in those types of strategic changes versus like, hey, should we reimburse for this drug or this device? So I don't think we've figured that out yet.
We have a few more questions coming in now.
Sure.
We have a question about how about Markov models in VIA? How do you incorporate them?
Budget willing is my answer. So what I would often say is that budget impact analyses are often the second or third aim of a grant. And personally, I struggle because they're often underfunded. And so I would love to see that these are given the due funding that they deserve, such that you're pulling great empirical data, you're able to do a great econometric analysis with the empirical data, and then you're figuring out whether you want to put that into a decision model. Now, you might, in your decision model, do it for a couple of reasons. One is you want to say, what does this mean for the next 3 years? And you still might want to build a model for that. But then you might also say, what does this mean for longer term? Because we're worried that the three-year model is biased. I don't think as a profession we're doing a great job on that, in part because the budgets aren't allowing us to do that. And so I struggle with that myself.
Okay. We have a question about whether VERA funds factor into your budget impact analyses.
So that has come up on a couple of the budget impact analyses. So you might think of a new program that changes the way that the coding is done such that the facility now has a higher, more severe case mix. And I should have stepped back a second for the folks that aren't familiar with VERA. It's the Veterans Equitable Resource Allocation. This is a case mix adjusted way that VA distributes money or calculates sort of what gets distributed to local facilities. For example, if a patient has a spinal cord injury and has two visits in that year to the facility with a documented spinal cord injury, they get a certain amount of money for it, and it's something like a little over $30,000 per year to manage that patient. So you could imagine an implementation study said maybe we have a lot of patients out there who only have one visit for their spinal cord injury. How do we bring these patients back in for the second? Now, that would clearly affect the revenue stream for the facility. In my experience, is that facilities are pretty sanguine about these already, and they do a pretty good job trying to maximize those reimbursements as best they can, because, like I said earlier, reimbursements are real money rather than projected savings. But again, you might in a study think about how would that affect your the Vera reimbursement for your facility.
I'll just note we're getting a lot of questions about people asking about the slides and archiving of the presentation. So I just want to note that the sessions will be archived online at the HSR&D website. If you want to provide contact information, we have a few questions asking for that as well for people who want to follow up with you, Todd.
Oh, that's great. I always love follow-up, especially if you're involved in the budget impact analysis. And for those of you who are in VA, it's just todd.wagner@va.gov. You can also reach me at Stanford, too. So either way, it's great.
And one more question. Is there any difference in how to conduct a cost analysis for CEA and budget impact analyses?
Can you restate that?
They want to know about differences in conducting costing for cost effectiveness analysis versus budget impact analysis.
Yeah, so that's a great question. The cost of the intervention itself may be very similar in both cases. So if you're intervening with a new, and let's just take the example that I gave of a health coach, and you're hiring new health coaches to do disease management coordination. In both cases, you have to do a good job estimating the costs of these health coaches. What's dramatically going to be different is the downstream benefits and how you're going to measure the outcomes. In the budget impact analysis, you're focused in the near term on estimated savings that would be attributed or come from reduced visits, fewer emergency room visits, maybe fewer hospitalizations because now the patients are healthier and managing their diseases better. Those don't always turn out to be the case, however, though. But those you could do in the budget impact analysis. While that would be true in the cost effectiveness analysis, the cost effectiveness analysis is also interested in understanding what's going to happen beyond 3 years. And so that's where that question, there was a person raised a question about a Markov model. Well, that's where these models come in very handy. As you then say, people are going to be in different health states. Maybe your intervention changed how these people, the rest of their life and how they're going to have future health states and those costs of the future health states. And the Markov model is perfect for that, but that's not typically done in a budget impact analysis.
Great. And I think that's about it for questions now.
Wow. Thank you. I would say that there's a lot of work that Joe and myself, Gene Yoon, and Wei Yu get on budget impact analyses. So feel free to reach out to us if you're knee-deep in these things. We also didn't get as much into it, but there's a whole growing field on sort of the budget impact analyses for implementation studies. And in that regard, you might be interested in not only understanding the cost of your intervention, the downstream costs, but now there might also be implementation costs as well that get you might want to measure separately for that. So feel free to reach out to us if you have further questions on these issues. Anything else, Joe?
That's it, I think. Yeah.
Well, thanks for everybody for hanging on for another installment of the Days of Our Lives, economic-wise. And Molly, thank you for helping on the technology front, as always.
We are always happy to be here to help out with feedback. Thank you, everyone, for joining us for today's HSR&D Cyber Seminar, and we look forward to seeing you at a future session. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.